Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. You know, there is nothing quite like a snow day.
Anna, go back to sleep.
I just can't. The sky's awake, so I'm awake. So we have to play.
Go play by yourself.
Do you want to build a snowman? Come on.
Anna and Elsa there from the Pixar movie Frozen as little girls. Of course, their adult versions played by Kristen Bell and Idina Menzel. Tonight, Boston and the region are expected to get our first snow of the winter, and it may not be snow day worthy, but the first snow of winter is still the first snow of winter. So let's check in on what we can expect out of the event with WBUR meteorologist David Epstein. Dave, welcome.
Hey, thank you very much, Tiziana. Good to be here.
So lay it out for us, Dave. Start time, end time. How much? What's the rundown?
Yeah, this is not a big deal. So we've got a few snow showers around the area overnight tonight. Some areas will probably not see anything at all. But if you're going to see snow, it's going to be between about 8 o'clock tonight and about 1 or 2 o'clock tomorrow morning. And the ground could turn white in some spots. I think the roads will be fine. It's been warm. Temperatures are in the mid to upper 30s, even near 40 this afternoon. So the problem with any, you know, the reason we're not getting a big snowstorm is it's a nice storm, but it's just way out in the fish, and so it's providing rain and snow. We'll move into eastern Canada. But for us, this may be the first snow showers for some of us. It's certainly the first widespread snow in the forecast, but, you know, it's really a dusting to an inch kind of thing.
All right, fair enough. So look into your crystal ball if you can. Do we think it's going to be a snowy winter? What do the signs suggest?
Yeah, so, you know, I've been writing about this for several weeks. We're in a La Nina year, and when you get La Nina years, it tends to be a year in which we get snow that's less than average in southern New England. The other factors that we've looked at, so warm and wet falls also tend to bring about less snow and warmer conditions than average for the winter. And then there's another leading indicator, which is December. So if December ends up warmer than average with less snow, it tends to sort of follow that the next 2 months of meteorologic winter, January and February, also tend to be months where you'll see less snow than average. And I definitely think that December, I think there's no doubt December is going to end up warmer than average. I don't want to say that we'll have less snow than average because there could be something that occurs on December 30th that I don't see in my crystal ball. But right now we are going to be snow free for the next 10 to 14 days anyway. And temperatures are going to be in the 50s, perhaps even 60s by the time we get to next week. We also have a 60 degree day coming up on Saturday with some showers. So we are not in a winter pattern by any means.
All right. So in like a sentence, remind those who haven't driven on snow in a while, number one safety tip.
Just leave more distance between yourself and the car in front of you and expect roads to be slippery that are untreated because the stopping distances really do increase when you have snow on the ground. I don't think folks will get much practice here over the next 20 hours or so, but nevertheless, I'm sure you and I will be having a conversation eventually when we will be talking about plowing and sanding and salting and all of that.
All right, WBUR meteorologist Dave Epstein. Dave, thanks.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
You too. And now with snow on the way, many communities are getting their snow clearing fleets ready, or they're trying. There is a shortage of workers to drive the plows and keep the streets clean. Later in the hour, we're going to talk about shortages in other industries, from bus drivers to healthcare, bartenders at your favorite restaurant. But let's start with the people who keep the roads clear. Earlier today, we spoke with Jim Stanford. He is the director of public works for the town of North Andover. And he said the driver shortage is real, and getting the roads plowed quickly and safely is more important now than ever.
Well, I mean, given that we've had a year of COVID, a little over a year of COVID, and we know what the school systems, how much was missed, I think it's more critical than ever that, you know, we get the roads cleared so that kids can get to school safely. In addition to that, you know, it's important for commerce. I mean, residents need to get to work and get to where they're going during the day.
So what's the gap between the number of drivers you need and the number that you have?
So we have a combination of our in-house employees. We also have a number of contractors. We typically have about 100 pieces of contracted equipment. This past year, we've been notified by a couple of our major contractors. We've lost about 20 pieces of equipment just this year alone.
So you're 20 short overall, or is it bigger than that?
This past year, we've lost 20. We've lost probably 10 to 15 prior to that in prior years. We've just seen this slow progression. So at this point, this week, we got some good news that we did have a couple of local contractors who are going to be able to put a couple of pieces, extra pieces of equipment on for us. But we're still substantially low. I would say at least 20 pieces of equipment right now.
So what do you do? How do you get them in? For example, I hear exorbitant offers from cities and towns for hourly pay. What's your strategy?
We did a review of what we were paying, and we actually increased our rates by about 30%. We felt that that was the most prudent thing to do.
So 30% is a lot. So what are your rates now?
For a major piece of equipment, let's say a front-end loader or a tri-axle truck, we're looking at about $200 an hour.
Roughly how many hours will one of those pieces of equipment and driver get in a medium snow year?
We generally budget for about 25 storms per year, and that's not full storm. It's also ice and in slippery conditions. We spend about $1 million between salt, contracted services, and employees. In a medium year, we're generally going over that $1 million.
You said to the Boston Globe that this is the worst shortage you've seen in 30 years. So that tells me two things. One, we've had shortages before. And two, boy, this one's bad. So A, yes on shortages before, and B, why so bad right now?
You know, we're really trying to figure that out. And it's not just for snow plowing. It's just about any position we have within public works. I can tell you over the 30 years, when we used to advertise a truck driver position, not just in North Andover, but any municipality that I've worked for, we'd have 20 to 30 applicants. Now we're struggling if we even get one or two applicants. So it's not just snow plowing. It's just, I would say, municipal government working for public works. It's hard work. You know, I think one of the appeals that municipalities used to have, the benefits, the longevity, and those were things that used to entice people to come. I think there's probably a little bit of shift in the younger generation where maybe they're looking a little bit more at what the pay is now, maybe not as concerned about the future in retirement.
So what do you do? How do you fix this long term? Obviously, you raise wages for now, but what are the other pieces of the solution as you see it?
Well, one of the things that we're trying to do is we're actually trying to get a pilot program with a couple of the tech schools in the area to see if we can get high school students who might be interested in going into public works. I mean, because it's, you know, it's not just plowing. We have water treatment. There's a lot of technical aspects to the job now. So we're trying to get that started. We usually have a couple of interns, at least at the college level. And now we're starting to think maybe if we can get them at the high school level just to get interested, introduce them to the various job positions we have and, you know, the growth potential that's going to be in municipal work within the next 20 years, I think is tremendous.
So bottom line, when it comes down to it for this winter, is there a chance you'll have enough drivers, or do we basically already know you're just going to be short?
We know we're going to be short. It really means that, you know, a typical storm that used to take 4 to 8 hours to clear may now take 10 to 12 hours. It's going to be just longer durations for us to get everything cleared and get it to the level that the community has expected over the years.
That's Jim Stanford, Director of Public Works for the Town of North Andover. Jim, thanks. Good luck this winter.
Thank you very much.
Before the break, we heard from North Andover's Director of Public Works about a regional shortage of plow drivers as our first dusting of snow is about to be upon us. But as you've probably heard, that is not the only worker shortage impacting our economy right now. And all of that as we see more workers organizing, unionizing, going on strike. So is there a reason to be concerned long term, or is this just a moment? A blip on the radar. Let's ask Tom Jurevich. He is a labor historian and a professor at the UMass Amherst Labor Center. Tom Jurevich, welcome to Radio Boston.
Tiziana, great to join you.
Great to have you. So painful for cities and towns to try to find snow drivers, snow plow drivers, but there's others. Governor Baker had to call the National Guard in to help with school bus driver shortage. The medical director from Worcester's Department of Public Health told us earlier this week they're facing staffing shortages in their regions. You know, Starbucks, limited hours in a lot of local Starbucks. They're raising wages in 22 because of labor shortages. So are all these things connected? And why are we seeing such widespread shortage?
They are entirely connected, and this doesn't surprise me at all. Jim's problem in North Andover, issues at Starbucks and across the economy. This is what we've seen across the U.S. and across the economy, particularly in seasonal jobs, low-wage jobs, but also some highly skilled jobs. And I think there's a couple of factors behind this.
Jump in. Tell me.
Yeah. Well, first is that we really didn't recover from the Great Recession. Oh, the stock market recovered. But if you look on Main Street, workers' wages didn't go up. And most working people got by what? Working a bit more overtime, taking on that second job, maybe putting some more money on the credit card. So going into COVID, workers were already working too hard for too little. And then COVID-19 struck. Right. And during that time of being laid off and furloughed, a lot of workers really began to question these kinds of contingent low wage jobs. And many people have talked about the great resignation, that people just didn't return. They left the labor market, and some were forced out of the labor market, like women, for example. Women were forced out because they had to take care of their kids who were home from school, the price of daycare. And a new study today showed that at the current rates, it's going to take 2 years before the women's participation in the labor force is going to equal what it was before COVID-19.
So, you know, in hearing you, I had expected, I think, one thing. I wanted to ask you, okay, in healthcare, we're really seeing shortages, nursing shortages. We had a story on WBUR earlier this week about mental health worker shortages. I assumed that you were going to say that's categorically different because of the pandemic. But now I wonder, is it all of a piece, or is there something different going on in the healthcare industry than in some of these other industries?
No, I think it's all of a piece. And what's all of a piece is that people are working too hard for too little. And what's interesting, if you look, people talk about the nursing shortage. There are actually over 1 million nurses in the U.S. who have decided to leave the profession. And why have they left the profession? Because they can't work the kinds of grueling shifts, even before COVID set in, that have become part of healthcare. They've left the profession. They left the profession to do other things because they can't work those kinds of hours under that kind of stress. And we've seen the same thing in meat packing. We've seen it in food production. These workers have been working very hard now for 2 years, and many of them, you know, for a decade before then. And workers have had enough. And I think that's what we're seeing. And this is, I think, a very unique moment in our history right now where workers are saying, I've had enough. I can't work these hours. And in some instances, they're saying, okay, we're going to organize into a union so we can make a difference. And in other cases, they're striking. They're saying, we're going to stop this until we get into a situation where we can earn really what we deserve.
So that's a great segue. And in a minute, I'm going to ask you to hold on. We're going to bring in a couple of people engaged in some labor action right now, and we'll come back to you. But in setting that up, so is it in fact the case that we are seeing more labor action right now, unionizing, organizing activity, work stoppages, et cetera, than we would have, say, 3 or 4 years ago?
Oh, absolutely. There's no doubt that there is a strike wave happening right now. Because, you know, again, I like to think about it. It's not a shortage of workers. It's a shortage of good jobs. And if we made those jobs better, not only in terms of salary, but in terms of scheduling and so on and conditions and so on, we'd have people lining up to take them. And this is the real challenge right now, is I think employers haven't really risen to the occasion. Now, Jim talks about raising their salary, and it is true in some skilled professions, they are trying to buy people into that. But part of it is also has to do with the conditions in those industries. And nurses, boy, we have worked them to death.
All right. Just to keep our listeners, for those who have joined us, when you said, Jim, you were referring to the director of public works in North Andover, who we talked to earlier in the show about snowplow driver shortages. All right. So, Tom, I'm going to ask you to hang tight for a couple of minutes, if you don't mind. I want to bring in a couple of other voices to the conversation, and then I will come back to you. So we're going to turn to a couple of folks who can talk about the labor portion of this from an on-the-ground perspective. Joining us now, Eve Mayberger, assistant conservator at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston. She's also a member of a 9-person bargaining committee currently negotiating their union's first contract with management. Her union's first contract. Eve, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you for inviting me to be part of this conversation.
And also with you, Maida Rosenstein, president of the United Auto Workers Local 2110, the union MFA employees recently joined. Maida, welcome to you as well.
Hi, thanks. Thanks for inviting me. And hi, Tom. Nice to hear from you.
Okay, so listen, as we jump into this, I want to note we reached out to the MFA directly and invited management to appear. They declined. They referred us to a written statement put out in response to a one-day strike from last month. We will get to that in a little bit, but I do want to start with the two of you. Eve, I know your organizing efforts began before the pandemic. Tom and I were talking about the pandemic piece of this, but you started before that. Why? Why did you organize, and what are you hoping to achieve by unionizing?
Yeah, and I think that's a great question, and it really fits into this larger conversation. So I've been at the museum about 5 years, and I have to say, you know, it's a great place to work, but, you know, there are certain things, you know, whether it's, you know, certain working conditions, low compensation, all these kind of larger issues that have been discussed. And so there was a group of people that kind of started meeting very informally in the summer of 2019, just trying to think about, you know, what can we do to better our work environments, because we love the work and we want to continue doing it, but how do we make this sustainable for everyone? And so we kind of looked around like the cultural heritage sector and kind of, you know, to see what other models were there. And we're very fortunate that there is other museums that have been unionized. For example, the Museum of Modern Art in New York City has been unionized since the 1970s. And, you know, talking to colleagues there, looking at the contracts, they have some of the highest wages and, you know, perks in kind of the whole sector. And so thinking about that as a way to move forward. So kind of based on those conversations, we kind of reached out to various unions and ended up selecting to work with United Auto Workers Local 2110. And that's how we kind of got in touch with Maida.
And Eve, so just kind of, so just briefly there, what is the primary focus here? Is it hours? Is it wages? Is it benefits? What's the main goal?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's all of those. And I should say that one of the things that makes our union really specific is that we're a wall-to-wall union. So we encompass everyone from people that are, you know, taking tickets at the front, you know, working in the bookstores, to, you know, I'm a conservator, to curatorial, publications. So we're really broad. So everyone kind of, depending on what their function at the museum, has different interests. But, you know, as we started having a lot of these one-on-one conversations, you start seeing general trends, whether it's, you know, long hours or being asked to do extra beyond the scope of your job, you know, increasing kind of stagnant wages. You know, these are all things that kind of came up repeatedly that we are hoping to address through our unionization.
So I'm going to turn to you, Maida, now. WBUR covered the one-day strike held last month, and I wanted to ask you about that. Certified union membership last December, it's tough to nail down how long a first contract, you know, takes on average, but legal experts say a year or more is not uncommon. Bloomberg Law published an analysis last summer looking at about 330 contracts that found the average negotiation for a first contract was just over 400 days. That's more than a year. This was certainly less than a year. So why did it feel you feel that a strike was necessary fairly early in the process?
Well, I think the museum's position at the table was they took a very hardball or intransigent stance on wages and compensation. You know, it took them months to respond to our compensation proposal. And when they did, they came in with a response that was extremely low offer, you know, basically no guaranteed increases at all until 2024, didn't deal with any of the structural inequities that people were seeking to address to begin with when they organized. But the backdrop to this was, you know, we had been for months negotiating over very basic contract language, basic rights like a grievance procedure, union security clause, protection on health and safety and non-discrimination, seniority and promotion rights. And the museum had been extremely difficult about all of these issues. And the progress was just painstakingly slow. And
so
they were
I'm
going to
stop you there
all.
Just because we have a tight clock and there are a couple more questions I want to ask the two of you. So I do want to get in a piece of the statement that the MFA gave us. It's dated from November 12th. I want to note that. It says, in part, for 7 months, we've met in good faith at the bargaining table, making positive progress and engaging in productive dialogue with the union, despite serious financial challenges to the arts and nonprofit sector stemming from the pandemic and a slow return to normalcy. Our goal has always been to recognize and support our employees. It goes on to say a little later, the union's committee has now gone over 7 weeks without responding to our wage proposal. And there was, they have claimed, a seven-week gap. Talk about that seven-week gap.
Well, first of all, it's not true. We actually did respond to their proposal. We told them the problems with their proposal, but their proposal was so low that we really felt, we told them that it was going to be very, very difficult for us to respond. And in addition, there were so many other issues, very standard contract issues that they had not agreed to, like a union security clause, giving us basic union rights, even, grievance and arbitration took 6 months for us to negotiate a grievance and arbitration clause. So, their position, I would say, as someone who has negotiated many contracts and including contracts with museums, was at the table, was quite anti-union. And statement is not really credible.
Thanks. I appreciate that. So one more question to you, Eve. You're in this process. Are you feeling hopeful? Are you feeling like you, the union and the museum are going to get to a place that works?
I have to be hopeful because I have to believe in the power of organized labor. And, one thing that has been just personally wonderful is that, the museum was very siloed in many ways. And throughout this process, I've had the opportunity of meeting and getting to know many of my amazing colleagues. And, like we said, we've been at this 7 months. I'm hopeful that we will continue to work together and really build a lasting relationship. This is just kind of chapter one in this relationship. Like, we're not, the union is going to be here. This is just a first contract. And so I am hopeful that, at the end of the day, we can come back to our membership and have something that we can really support, and that in subsequent contracts, we can kind of build on that relationship and the structures that we've established.
Okay, Eve Mayberger, Assistant Conservator at the Museum of Fine Arts here in Boston, and Maida Rosenstein, President of the United Auto Workers Local 2010. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you so much.
So turning back to you, Tom Jurevich, still with us, reactions to what you just heard, does that sound in line with reasons to organize and what the tensions between employers and unions are today?
It's a perfect case study. Tiziana, I really appreciate you did the research and pointed out that, first contracts often take more than a year. My own research shows this. The problem is that's not justice. I mean, that's not fair to a group of employees who've decided to organize. And our labor law is broken in this country that allows for employers to have that kind of delay. And I think what we're seeing in their one-day strike and in strikes that are happening all over the country is that workers are saying, this isn't fair. This isn't right. This isn't justice. This isn't what the original labor law was designed for in this country. It was designed to give people justice and the democratic right to choose an organization to represent them. And that's why, across the sectors, education, healthcare, we've seen a long strike in Worcester, in Kellogg's, at John Deere, at Nabisco. There's just been a series of strikes. And I think that's what that's really indicating, is that workers think the system is rigged unfairly against them. And they're going to stand up and use their collective power to try to get, better jobs that can allow them to take care of themselves and their families.
In a sentence, Tom, is this an inflection point for the future of work in the country and in the Commonwealth?
Yes, this is a fulcrum, and I think we're going to see a lot of activism increase in these years to come.
All right, that is Tom Jurevich, labor historian and professor at the UMass Amherst Labor Center. Really appreciate you joining us. Thanks so much for the time.
Thank you so much.
Rachel Rollins will officially become the first Black woman to serve as U.S. attorney in Massachusetts. It comes after a fiery confirmation process and a roll call vote today, the first time that has happened since 1975. Senate Minority Leader Mitch McConnell sounded the Republican objections to the Suffolk County DA.
Law-abiding Americans don't want prosecutors who refuse to prosecute. They don't want city jails equipped with revolving doors, and they need leaders who will defend the rule of law.
But ultimately, the Senate voted to confirm her less than an hour ago, with Vice President Kamala Harris casting the tie-breaking vote. So to talk about what that means, we are joined by Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School, and WBUR's legal analyst. Judge Gertner, you led the search committee appointed by Senators Markey and Warren to nominate the next U.S. attorney for Massachusetts. So let me ask you, how are you reacting to today's vote?
I think it's a wonderful thing that has happened. I think that she will be a breath of fresh air. Listening to Senator McConnell's comments, what she has done with the policy she implemented in Suffolk was actually improve law enforcement by enabling them to focus on actually important cases. It was really just the opposite. Crime has actually gone down on her watch. So he's just wrong, and I hope that she follows through on some of these promises in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
So I do want to underscore that people arrested but not prosecuted on low-level nonviolent misdemeanors, like shoplifting, drug possession, motor vehicle offenses, according to our own reporting here at WBUR, were 58% less likely to commit another crime in Suffolk County in the following 2 years, according to a recent study. So there's the data. I want to start with the vote, Judge Gertner. It was tight. I was watching it here on a TV screen in Studio 3, right, as the show is launching, and you wind up at 50-50. Kamala Harris, the vice president, has to break the tie. We wind up with a roll call vote, the first time since 1975 that has happened. Did you think it was going to be this much of a fight?
Well, I didn't anticipate that, but, you know, when you have the politics of caricature, that's what's going to happen, the politics of caricature. And because she is outside of the mainstream, right, because she's tried to do unusual things, like things that other progressive prosecutors have done, she winds up being attacked and, as I said, caricatured more than anything else. But the things that she's done have been important, about low-level offenders, about the conviction integrity unit, about looking at disproportionate sentencing. These are all things that all prosecutors should be doing, and I look forward to watching her in the U.S. Attorney's Office.
So Senator Tom Cotton from Arkansas early on took sort of an over-my-dead-body approach to the nomination. We covered that over the summer. He's made a lot of arguments over time, Judge Gertner, that D.A. Rollins's positions on do not prosecute, on her approach to criminal offenses and recidivism, are a defense attorney's perspective, and that a prosecuting attorney's perspective needs to be a different one. Now, at the same time, it's worth noting that in her past, D.A. Rollins served as a prosecuting attorney. But I do want to ask you, is there a mindset that the U.S. attorney needs to have, question A, and question B, do you feel confident that Suffolk County D.A. Rollins, now about to be U.S. attorney, has that mindset?
The mindset that a U.S. attorney should have, in the best of all possible worlds, is that they are an officer of the court. In other words, they are not, prosecution and punishment at all costs. They have a larger role than simply the narrow role of, you know, winning this or that case. And we count on them for that role. We count on them to determine, particularly with the federal resources, you understand, the federal resources are enormous. So we count on them to determine which are the most important cases to go after, which are the least important. How do I best deploy the extraordinary power of the federal government, particularly in dealing with street crime and drug trafficking? And that's the prosecutor mindset. It's not, you know, I'm going to let everybody off. No one ever said that. It was a question of how to appropriately deploy the awesome resources of the office. And that's going to be an issue that every prosecutor has to deal with. Otherwise, you wind up, you know, when someone comes in, they give you a case, you say, okay, fine, I'll go with it, rather than exercising judgment about what they ought to be prosecuting. And so I think that she has the appropriate mindset, and I don't care what the label is.
And how do you think she will deploy the awesome resources of the office? And how do you think that might be different? I mean, she is a reformer. How do you think that might be different than previous U.S. attorneys here in the Commonwealth?
Well, she has to, it's a more collaborative job than the Suffolk County DA. The Suffolk County DA has the authority of having been elected. And so she has the people to basically, to deal with. A U.S. attorney has to deal with the president, has to deal with, more significantly, the attorney general, has to deal with national policies. She has a great deal of individual discretion, no question about it, but it has to be consonant with the broader policies of the administration, of the Department of Justice, not the administration so much. So it's a more collaborative job. She'll have to harness resources, in league with other entities. She has to work. She doesn't have just the police to deal with. She has numbers of federal agencies that she is has to sort of bring on board. How will she be different than others? Well, she comes to the table with a sense of what's important and what is not. And it's not clear to me that other prosecutors may develop that kind of idea over time, but she has a real perspective about over-criminalization, over-punishment, over-policing, that has really stood her in good stead in the DA's office. Let me also say, by the way, that the Suffolk County DA and the U.S. attorney have overlapping jurisdiction with respect to most drug crimes. So she knows up close and personal the impact that the war on drugs and mass incarceration has had on communities of color. And that should inform what she does as U.S. attorney.
So she stands to break the mold in some ways. We've had other reformers in the past. We've had other firsts. We've had a woman U.S. attorney before. We've had a person of color in the role. Is there a reformer or a previous U.S. attorney that you find yourself thinking about or that she reminds you of? Or is she really something new?
The short answer is no. That's also the long answer. I can't think of anyone else who comes to this job with the perspective that she approaches it. I can't think of anyone. There have been people who in the job may have done interesting things, but she comes with a sense of what the communities of color in particular, poor communities, need and want. She's much more tied to the community than many other U.S. attorneys have been. We generally pick them from, big firms or people who've been in the U.S. attorney's office. This is a very unusual route for a U.S. attorney, and I think I really welcome her perspectives.
And in just a couple of sentences, Judge Gertner, advice. Longtime federal judge, trailblazing woman in law yourself, what advice would you give Rachel Rollins as she starts her new job?
Well, I think she has to go on a listening tour first, a listening tour of her office and the people she'll work with, a listening tour of the agencies that she'll be supervising, and a listening tour of the communities that the U.S. Attorney's Office, in fact, serves, to try to figure out how to put her stamp on this. She can't replicate the Suffolk County DA's office. It's a whole different setting and different personnel. But she can certainly inform what she's doing here with that perspective. So I would advise her to listen first and then figure out what her priorities are.
All right. That is Nancy Gertner, retired federal judge, senior lecturer at Harvard Law School and WBUR's legal analyst. Thanks, Judge Gertner.
Thank you.
Finally tonight, we have a question for you. When you hear the word witch, what comes to mind? Maybe it's a pointy hat, broomstick, bubbling cauldron, book of spells. Maybe it's a mortifying chapter in our region's history, one steeped in fear-mongering and death. Well, those are certainly what we've grown accustomed to in our movies and our history books. But an exhibit at Salem's Peabody Essex Museum aims to introduce us to today's witches, sans broomsticks, while also confronting the dungeons and hanging trees of our own storied past. The collection is The Salem Witch Trials, Reckoning and Reclaiming. It's now open. And in October, we spoke with Associate Curator Lydia Gordon and photographer Francis Denny, whose photos of modern-day witches are featured in the exhibit. We wanted to bring you that conversation again tonight. And when we talked, we began with Frances Denny describing her favorite photo in the collection.
Oh, well, it's really hard to choose amongst all of my subjects. So you can't tell any of them that I had to, because I might get some heat later on. But I think if I had to choose one, Karen's portrait really stands out for me. Karen owns an apothecary in Flatbush, Brooklyn. And when I first initially reached out to her about being part of my project, she, I think, was a little hesitant, but she agreed to sit for me and invited me into her apothecary. And I photographed her and interviewed her. And she ended up being a really powerful presence in that room, I think.
And who are, in general, the women in these pictures, Frances? Who are today's witches?
So it is hard to generalize, right? Because there are so many different kinds of ways of embodying this word witch. Pictured in these images, you have Wiccan high priestesses. You have people who would consider themselves pagan, many who don't consider themselves pagan. There are people who practice mysticism or engage with the occult. There are politically oriented activist witches. Polytheists also who work within a pantheon of goddesses. There are tarot readers, astrologers, people who practice spellcraft, and quite a few plant-based healers who sometimes go by the moniker of Green Witch. So hopefully that gives you a little bit of a sense of the breadth of the way that people have come to this word and reclaimed it for themselves.
So, Lydia, I want to note Frances's book, where these pictures came from, is called Major Arcana, Portraits of Witches in America. Frances just gave us a very wide-ranging sample of women who could be witches. And this exhibit is to reclaim the word of witch. That's a central theme. So I'm going to be deliberately kind of obtuse for a minute here. How can all of that be a witch?
Right. Well, I think Frances spoke really eloquently about her project in so that it is a spectrum of identity. You know, the contemporary witch identity that these folks are really self, you know, claiming for themselves is a spectrum. It's a pantheon. No one witch is exactly the same. And it's really important to understand that, you know, our understanding of a witch is very different today than it was in the 17th century, right? In the 17th century Puritan context, a witch was somebody that was working alongside the devil, right? Like against the Christian church. And what Frances's project really does quite beautifully, elegantly, and powerfully is diversify our perception of witches today, as well as reclaim that power and that word from, you know, this really baggaged history.
The exhibit, Lydia, also focuses on the baggaged history. And I guess I'm assuming that most of us know the Salem witch trials were bogus at this point, but is that a safe assumption?
It was a crisis made up of hysteria and founded on, you know, people who were really in it for land grabs and money. And there were all these sort of conflicting arenas in Salem. And what is very evident in looking at this history and doing the research is that, you know, no one was safe from being accused. This movement, this wave of crisis really went across all social strata, but it is significant that most of the people, not all, but most of them who were accused and tried and executed were women.
So we are discussing a new exhibit at the Peabody Essex Museum that aims to reclaim the word witch. We're talking with Lydia Gordon, Associate Curator of the Peabody Essex Museum, and Frances Denny, a photographer who has photos in the exhibit. So, Frances, it kind of blew my mind to find out that you are both a descendant of someone responsible for condemning accused witches in Salem and a descendant of an accused witch. What does it feel? How do you carry around both of those contradictions, right, in your DNA, and how did that motivate your work?
Yeah, when I made that discovery, looking through my family tree, it felt irreconcilable. It was not something I could, you know, seal up in an envelope and get rid of in the mail. You know, it was something that stuck with me. And in fact, I kind of tucked it away because I knew that I needed to come back to it at a later date and really focus my art on it. And that's exactly what I did. I got interested in this word witch and how it has sort of traveled through time, acquiring all of this baggage. You know, you have the Spanish Inquisition, the Salem witch trials, the Brothers Grimm fairy tales with the hag in the woods preying on children. And then you look at the 20th century, you have the Disney witch with green skin and a hooked nose and a pointy hat, and the television shows around witches. And so, you know, as I thought more deeply about this word and how it's traveled through time, I thought, well, aren't there people who identify as witches now? Because I truly didn't know much about this contemporary world of witchcraft at all.
And briefly, how did you find them, Frances?
Mm-hmm. So I started by writing a letter of intent, kind of an artist statement, and I sent it to a few individuals that I sort of had a hunch about, that I thought would sort of understand what I was after, who I wouldn't completely offend by sending this letter. And lo and behold, they did agree to be photographed and interviewed for the project. And then they ended up introducing me, or sort of referring me, to coven mates or friends. And from there, the project really grew really quickly. It became this massive web sort of spanning the U.S. And I ended up photographing over 75 individuals around the country who identify as witches.
So Lydia, at the beginning of this conversation, Frances told us about one of those photographs. Tell us, there are two other parts to this exhibit. Maybe tell us about those two other parts by telling us about some item in each one of those two other parts.
Sure. So the other contemporary artist in the exhibition is the fashion designer Alexander McQueen. And McQueen was actually a descendant as well from an accused individual in the Salem witch trials named Elizabeth Howe. And he did his research to find out what her situation was and her trial and what she was being accused of. And he ended up creating an entire collection in 2007 in her memory. And so we own one of the spectacular gowns from that collection, and that is featured as well in the exhibition. And then the first part, really, of the show and the experience is 1692. So we really try to ground visitors in that history. And we have a vignette of 17th century object that greets the visitors to sort of give a sense of what it was like to live in Salem back then, which was a very scary place. And we have this incredible window that was part of the Putnam's house, and it would sort of reflect this idea of living inside and outside and peering through, and hysteria and, you know, sort of gossip and not quite knowing, you know, where you are, who you can trust. And so the whole experience of the exhibition is quite you know, it's quite emotional, and we try to go from this sort of darkness to lightness.
I believe that the dress that you're describing, there's a picture of the neckline of that dress on the website for the exhibit. It's all beaded and high-necked and dark, and I don't know, there's something powerful about it.
Oh, yeah, it's totally fierce. I mean,
yeah, that's the word.
Yeah, he is, you know, he's not really holding back. And, you know, there's so much about when you wear something that makes you feel good, you know, you're kind of arming yourself, right? And I absolutely get that sense when I experience that show-stopping piece.
So, Frances, I heard you say, mm-hmm. And so now that we've introduced this word fierceness, riff on that with your work.
Well, I mean, just about McQueen and his work for a moment, I think that I think he understood how, you know, there is a power in fearfulness and fearsomeness, and he embraced that in his design. He armed women, as Lydia said. So I think that the people that I photographed have also sort of armed themselves in a sense with their witchcraft, because I think at its essence, witchcraft is really about the cultivation of an inner power. It's about being in tune with oneself and with the earth, and for finding kind of alternative systems for processing the world around us, the energy around us. And, you know, I think in a time when so many of us feel a great deal of powerlessness, you know, in the face of a global pandemic and political unrest. I hope that visitors to the show will be moved by the ways in which my subjects have found ways to navigate life with more magic and wisdom.
So Lydia, not to put too fine a point on it, but listening to Frances there, I find myself thinking this exhibit takes us from a time where if you were a powerful woman, it could get you hanged, to a time when we have women Marvel superheroes. So I wonder, has the change in our understanding of the word and the concept witch mirrored our changing understanding of what it means to be a woman?
I mean, I think that that question and that identity is always in flux and it's ever expanding, right? I mean, it's wonderful that we have more representation in the media, in our lives, especially in the museum world and art. We see ourselves in a whole spectrum in, you know, diverse experience being represented and celebrated. But, you know, the war on women has still not ended, right? It manifests perhaps differently now, but that fear and control is still very much there in our culture.
All right. So before we go, how can people find out more information? How do they view the work on display? Frances, is this the only place people can see your photos? So Frances, you first.
I have a book that is also includes all 75 portrait subjects, and as well as essays written by the subjects, which was important to me to have their voices be a part of this. They're also part of the show. So the show is at the Peabody Essex Museum in Salem, and the book is at the show and in the bookstore, and in all fine places that books are sold. It's called Major Arcana: Portraits of Witches in America.
And Lydia, how can people find out more about attending the exhibit?
Sure. So if you go to PEM.org, the exhibition page is our landing page. So you will find all information about coming to visit the museum there. The exhibition is up through March 20th.
That's Lydia Gordon, associate curator at the Peabody Essex Museum, and photographer Frances Denny, talking to us back in October about the new collection, The Salem Witch Trials, Reckoning and Reclaiming. That collection is now open through March 20th, as Lydia said. And just a quick note here, WBUR is an in-kind media partner for the exhibit. That's our show for today. Thanks so much for listening. Radio Boston is produced by Jamie Bologna, Chris Siderick, Walter Wuthman, Amanda Beeland, and Cynthia Betubiza. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Karen Schiffman is our interim executive producer, and I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.